gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good, then. Well, then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast.
Welcome back to part two of Fighting in the War Room's Top 10 2016s. I'm Dave Gonzalez. I got Katie Rich, Matt Patches, and David Ehrlich. They've all come up with their top 10 lists of films for 2016. We did 10 through 6 on a previous episode. You should probably go check that out, unless you're just one of those crazy spoiler people that just wants the best of the best, the cream of the crop, the butter on the top of our shook milk, in which case this is the goddamn episode for it.
Wow.
Yeah, that's right.
I love this energy you're bringing.
I go hard for part two. They've had a whole week to, you know, stop and process our picks. So let's give them more picks to process. Katie, you're going to kick us off with your number five choice, Moonlight, which is maybe the most pleasant film to watch visually for me that I saw this year.
Oh, interesting. There's been a lot of visually good films this year. And I wanted to shout out Arrival because it's got cinematographer Bradford Young for its cinematography. But that's not what this movie is. Moonlight. I'm the first one of us to talk about it. I mean, this movie's been widely discussed. We have talked about it. It is probably the most critically acclaimed film of the year, or at least one of two. I still have a tough time. I've only seen it the one time, but I still have a tough time with the middle section of this movie, which I think we talked about. It didn't totally ring true for me, but there's so much great in this movie. There's great acting. There is great depth of feeling, the writing, the strength of the characters, just the entire role of Mahershala Ali and the way his character resonates through this three-part film. You know, again, Moonlight's been widely discussed. So I don't want to try to add anything new to this conversation, but it has stuck with me in a way that I think maybe I didn't even expect when I first saw it, and not just because it's picking up all of these awards. It's a really, truly unique film and kind of brings your head to this place that it wouldn't be otherwise.
Is there a moment in the movie that stands out to you that where you were kind of like, whoa, this is... a heavy hitter. This is more than...
Well, like when I realized it was like doing something?
Yeah, well, I mean, calling it unique, and I think I would agree with you, as you probably will later discuss, but I am curious if there's something that you really cling to or that kind of felt eye-opening.
Well, I think in the early part of the film, I was struggling with Naomi Harris's character, who I don't think ever truly
I don't think she works
emerges
at all.
as strong. Yeah, I her character was kind of striking me the wrong way, and I was kind of being like, how are you going to address this story of life in the project for African Americans, which is a story that we've seen a decent amount of times on film. And then Mahershala Ali's character and the kind of famous baptism scene where he's teaching the character how to swim is kind of when you realize that this character isn't going to fit any of the beats that you've seen established for this kind of, like, you know, intimidating drug dealer before. And I think that was when the movie kind of grabbed me and said, not only is it, like, visually fantastic, where, you know, it takes Naomi Harris and has her in these, like, shots bathed in red light as this, like, you know, mysterious mother figure, but the way that it develops that character, and then you also meet Janelle Monáe's character, who's his wife or girlfriend or someone, just the way that these people emerge, and it proves you that it's telling a different kind of story, I think, is when it grabbed me.
Right.
For sure. I think me coming out of this with, like, the history of Kodak film stock not always being able to pick up black people and skin tone as clearly as white skin tones, I realized this was the movie that hit me in the face like a brick, that I, like, there's a whole period of my movie knowledge of just people not knowing how to light black skin. And Moonlight is the polar opposite of that in an amazing way.
When we talk about the best cinematography of the year, I think that's an important point to remember.
Well, moving right along, because I bet we're going to be revisiting Moonlight. Patches, you're also bringing up for the first time this movie that has a lot of buzz. It's a Natalie Portman vehicle, and there may not be any Camelot if you believe the trailer. I haven't seen it, so you got to let me know, or I could read a history book, I guess.
Yeah, you could probably dive in with some...
But don't let it be forgot, there was a place called Camelot. There was! That's what
there was.
Yes, I want my bit on Jackie to be Katie singing the Camelot soundtrack.
Oh, God. That's all I remember. I don't know Camelot, the musical, that well. This is kind of my introduction to it.
Clearly, you were not a high school theater geek in the 1980s. Neither was I.
As you were.
Talking about Jackie just a little bit, I might come up again, but people know that this is a film about Jackie Kennedy in the days, in the aftermath of the assassination of her husband, President John F. Kennedy, 1963. And I guess what really grabbed me about this movie was diverting from the normal biopic conventions or even some of the, like, you know, this movie, I believe, was developed as an HBO miniseries once upon a time. And sometimes HBO can do these kind of internal monologuing, you know, brought to life biopics where you're basically sitting in a dim room, you know, with like historical figures. And I don't know. This has an air of HBO in it. But Pablo Larraín, who I think we've lauded on this podcast before, Katie, you and I we loved No.
No!
A few years ago.
Chile.
I just think he brings. That was not a cue. You can sing the Chile TV ad song, but you cannot say Camelot. I guess
yeah.
It's good.
Well, I don't know any of the rest of the words because they're Spanish. Chile. I just know that I'm saying Chile.
Anyway, Pablo Larraín, I think, brings this thunderous control, this energy to portraiture of Jackie in these moments, you know, taking the iconography that people know why this assassination was so powerful. It sticks in the memories of so many people, you know, the Chanel, the pink Chanel dress. And now it's, as opposed to it being crimped and beautiful and something a fashionista might wear, it is soaked in blood. And that seems like the movie's entire purpose, to strip back the gloss of the Kennedy myth and figure out where it all came from. And I think Natalie Portman's control in this role, amplified by Mika Levy's score, just like this melting orchestra, this just chaos enveloping her, this mania that she's suffering, and while being totally poised, while still being the Jackie Kennedy people loved, this duality in this movie, it just really blew me away. And yeah, that's why I love Jackie. It might come up
later.
We'll talk about it. We'll talk about it later.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, for sure. Moving right along to things that we are only going to talk about once. Katie, no.
What?
Roll back. I skipped David entirely. I'm sorry, David.
Sad.
David, if rich people were hanging out and suddenly there was a murder, would you like that movie?
Historically, I might. It's although a bigger splash is a far cry from like the Gosford Parks of the world, at least in certain respects. But yeah, I mean, we spoke about this on last week's episode. So if you haven't listened to this, I would highly recommend it. I spoke in that segment, but I definitely echo everything that Katie said as well. I think that this is, yeah, I mean, we said what we had to say. I just think Ralph Fiennes, Tilda Swinton, Dakota Johnson, even Matthias Schoenhart, and really all the other people who have small roles in this movie. The guy who plays the Italian police inspector in the third act is especially memorable. Are brilliant. I just love the whole vibe of this movie. I love how it's shot. I love the zooms and the nudity and the artificial bits, like the shadow of the plane flying over the beach, and the way that old, like, music that is certainly not old-fashioned. I mean, I'm talking about like early Rolling Stones cuts, but like the way that it is breathed through with new life in some of the film's best sequences, how musical this film really is in a year where we finally got some full-fledged musicals. This almost feels like one of them. I really, really love this movie. I think that I was just gonna say the ratio between like movies that people would like and movies that people actually saw, like this is that movie that everyone would have really liked if only they had the chance to see it or gave themselves the chance. So please, please go watch this movie.
Do you see a Suspiria remake in the threads of A Bigger Splash? I think Luca Guadagnino is going off to do this movie with Tilda Swinton, actually, where she plays.
Wait, he's the guy who's... I feel like the Suspiria remake has been in like four different pieces.
Yeah, David Gordon Green was going to do it, but now a much better director. Well, I love David Gordon Green's movies, but...
It'd be very dangerous to suggest that a remake of Suspiria is going to be good just based on who's directing it, but I'm certainly a lot more interested in what he's going to do with it than I would be a lot of other people, David Gordon Green included. And I'm interested to see what Luca Guadagnino's like little new movie is about that's going to be at Sundance with some more American or English-speaking actors
Is Tilda in it?
Small Italian island. No, I think it's a... Judging by the log line description on the Sundance page, it's a homoerotic story about all men. So
That doesn't mean Tilda can't be in it.
That's so true.
Yeah. Well, we also know that David Gordon Green's working on Mud 2, The Legend of Curly's Gold. So we'll see how that works out.
He didn't even direct Mud.
It'll be fine. He'll be great for this. I just been waiting for to make a Mud's Curly's Gold joke for
Mud
quite a while.
I love that joke.
Mud 2. Katie, you have a film that isn't going to pop up again. So let's pause
that
and talk about
so much
Manchester by the Sea.
Yeah, I can't believe I'm the only one.
Well, it was on my
up.
List. It was just a little bit higher.
Right outside the 10.
Although my fiance came home from seeing it the other night, walked right into the bathroom, could be heard loudly crying for about 20 minutes, and then came out and was like straight pissed that I had put it so low on my list.
Wow.
So,
yeah. I mean, I don't know. I think I walked into this kind of ready to be skeptical because it's been lauded since Sundance. I didn't have a chance to see it until a couple days ago. And, you know, I was watching on a screener, as is my want these days, and was kind of worried it wouldn't work on me. But this movie, it's written and directed by Kenneth Lonergan. It is so impeccably written. The storytelling and the way these characters are developed and the way that it veers between comedy and tragedy within seconds of each other, and every word from out of everyone's mouths feels right. It's such a fantastic movie to live inside, as devastating as it is. And, you know, I am as fed up with hearing about Casey Affleck, especially his accusations of sexual assault that no one seems to want to talk about, and was really prepared to kind of sit back and, you know, judge him. But he is fantastic in this movie. He's playing this guy who's been kind of dealt one gigantic personal tragedy before the story begins that's revealed via flashback about halfway through. And at the beginning of the film, we see him coping with the death of his brother, who's played by Kyle Chandler. And, you know, if a movie begins with Kyle Chandler dying, you know that you're in for the darkest timeline, because Kyle Chandler represents everything good and wholesome in the world. And, I mean, the story is Casey Affleck and kind of working on this relationship with his nephew, played by Lucas Hedges, who I had never seen in anything before. I hear he was...
Yeah, you had.
Another movie called
Moonrise Kingdom.
Oh, shit. Is he in Moonrise... Wait.
He's in Moonrise Kingdom. He plays the bad boy. And he's also has a very small part in Grand Budapest Hotel.
Isn't he also in, like, The Slap or something? Yes, he was on The Slap, which I never saw.
Who could say?
he is such a really convincing teenager, and Casey Affleck is this really convincing, like, you know, blue collar guy who's basically waiting to die. And I was reading, I think it was my colleague Richard Lawson's review, who was talking about how his character, Lucas Hedges, is a teenager and he kind of has no choice but to live in the face of tragedy, whereas Casey Affleck is really trying not to. And that's kind of where the fundamental conflict comes between the two of them, and watching it play out is really gorgeous. And I think that Kenneth Lonergan, as a playwright, like, sometimes you could see his movies and be like, oh, well, it's really well written, but like, what's cinematic about it? But I think there's really effective editing in the way the flashbacks are used, and then also some shots. There's this, you know, shot that, you know, if you've seen the movie, you know what it means, where you see these three picture frames lined up on a dresser and they look like tombstones, and it's not really highlighted. You don't see what's in the frames. There's not a zoom in on them, but it's just there. And there's so many bits like that that make this feel really cinematic.
It also
being spectacularly
captures
written.
This like topography of the world around it. You know, it doesn't just have a setting. It lives and breathes Manchester by the Sea. And it's so vital to the atmosphere when these walk and talks are happening and how he's constructing scenes, the neighborhood that they live in, or even the rooms where scenes take place in. I was really struck by scenes where, like, Casey Affleck is installing lights and he's a handyman of the movie. Like, some of those scenes.
Oh, these early scenes are so funny.
Yeah, and they're really funny, or like his apartment, his sad sack apartment. It's so funny how humor can be sobering, and because moments in this movie are so devastating, it's hysterical at times. And
There's a lot of talk about how long it takes to get between various locations in the Metro Boston area that are really important to the story, but it's just being like, oh, well, they're in Beverly. It's 45 minutes to Beverly. No, it's an hour and a half to Beverly. And I think if you grew up in Boston, it must be even more entertaining than it was for me.
Sorry, guys. I'm writing Jeff Nichols an email. Just says David Gordon Green, Mud 2. Next up, we are once again returning to a movie that we've talked about. Patches, if you were to have not gotten married recently, what animal would you be in your singledom?
I've thought about this. I want to be a polar bear. Polar bears. Because they get
to
swim.
The world is not kind to your species now, though.
What? Oh, yeah. Are they going extinct?
The glaciers are.
They're so tough.
But you get to sell so much Coca-Cola.
I guess it's good I didn't pick giraffe. They're really... Anyway,
yeah, good point.
Yeah, I picked Yorgos Lanthimos's The Lobster, which we discussed in the earlier half of this episode last week. And, you know, we burrowed into this pretty deep. But the one thing I wanted to pose to you guys was, there's a lot of talk about Colin Farrell and how he's the keystone here, and it's certainly true, about kind of whiplash of the future, the dystopia of being forced to fall in love, and the dystopia of living in the wilderness, being single, swearing off love, and how this kind of jumbles him. What do you think of Rachel Weisz, who's someone I absolutely adore as an actress, who has this delicate performance in the latter half and, you know, has to make a case through emotion that maybe love is real and can be prosperous. What do you think of her performance? She really got under my skin here.
She's fantastic.
She's terrible. No, she's great.
Awful.
I think she's the perfect counterbalance to Colin Farrell's character, and has this sort of irrepressible, sentimental romantic streak, really, that is, you know, so oppressed throughout the rest of the movie. And Rachel Weisz does such a great job of, like, keeping it tampered down enough to survive, but making it clear enough to the people who are actively looking for it, who may feel the same way. So she's great.
Yeah, it's weird. She, for me, she captures this, like, this ruggedness that is required to live in the woods and fend for yourself, but also this kind of, like, childlike innocence that develops when people don't have real relationships, how that pang of love in your heart can evolve you, can mature you. It's a really captivating performance, and using futurist thinking and plotting to delve into new emotions that I don't get to see on screen very often because the setups would never allow them. So that's The Lobster.
Yay! I would be a mongoose, by the way, because you burrow and you could kill snakes. Just, you know,
why do you want to kill snakes?
Well, just because you're badass enough to kill snakes, if any snakes.
If you're living in
you.
The woods, you're probably running into a lot of snakes.
Oh yeah, and like underground, there's got to be like snake holes and stuff. We'll figure that out in a future episode.
Lobster 2
is a good idea.
Directed by David Gordon Green.
Search for Curly's gold. Okay, David, we finally get to talk about this. It's a long documentary that is being pushed in the feature documentary category, but is nonetheless a staggering piece of work. It's O.J. Made in America.
It is. And what a staggering piece of work it is. I think it's interesting to discuss whether or not it's film or television, what the distinction even means anymore, if we are sort of shackled to archaic definitions of these terms, and that's a binary that no longer really applies. But I am perfectly happy to see it as a film. A hell of a film it is. I mean, it's such a all-encompassing, it wouldn't work, first of all, in a much shorter version. It wouldn't have nearly the same power. I mean, this is a 7.5-hour movie that uses every single one of its minutes to deepen its examination into race in America. I mean, it would be impossible to, and this is going to be a hilariously self-evident comment to people who've been thinking about it this way for a long time, but I'm just talking about maybe the historical long view of O.J. Simpson. This movie really makes it ridiculous that anyone could think of the O.J. Simpson trial as not being about race, and could think about so many other things in our recent history as Americans. I don't know, more or less everything. I was going to say, I don't know, the 2016 election, but as being about race, just how deep and pernicious and elements of race are in this country, the racial divide, how O.J. Simpson navigated it is so fascinating. But the masterstroke of this movie is not that they just sort of reiterate and use all the footage to create the biggest 30 for 30 movie ever about the O.J. Simpson trial, but how they bookend it with hours of context of O.J. Simpson growing up, how he, by the time he reached college, was already sort of in the I'm not black, I'm O.J. category, and what that meant, and how he grappled with the aftermath of the trial and these amazing, really amazing scenes of him performing a flag lowering at his house before he moved for his friend who was videotaping him and doing it over and over, and what ultimately became of him. I mean, it's just, and it's so, the film is so well constructed, not in just some cheap chronology, but in how it makes sure that these ideas are laced from start to finish, that hold the whole thing together into a into one sort of coherent story, and that's a testament to the testimonies that Ezra Edelman, the director, was able to get and sought out. The access really couldn't be greater. And it doesn't feel like a polemic. It doesn't feel like it's attacking anything, but really just trying to present the most sober and comprehensive overview of an event that was such a tabloid sensation at the time. But I think what makes it so remarkable is that with every passing year, it actually only seems to be more and more of a central and figurative event in American history, and not this cheap thing that we were all obsessed with one summer. You know, like, this is really a huge landmark story about who we are in this country. And I think this is really the work that puts that into perspective once and for all.
Yeah, I think especially if you lived through it, because I talked to my dad after we both watched this, and he very plainly told me that he had no idea race was an issue while this was going on, which obviously was, you know, blindness of the time. But the fact that OJ can build this, as you said, in a way that's not a polemic, that's not like a wake up white people, but is a whole full story over its 7 and some hours, I think really benefits it over something like, you know, the JonBenet documentaries we got this year, which were really trash.
Which would be on your list. Oh, no.
No.
David, did you ever think that you would have a talking head documentary on your best of list?
No. I mean, that's technically what OJ is, but certainly its scope sort of flattens that angle of it out.
I just thought about that because I know when we talk about documentaries, we have to talk about how, like, this is the lowest form in some ways.
But it's also like also like a justification of that approach, because it would be really hard to think of any other way to do this in this way.
Well, and also when you have people looking back on events from the past and kind of talking to you over footage of them in the past, or, you know, of evidence of it. I mean, I think about Marsha Clark talking about what was happening in the trial, and then there's a guy who's one of OJ's childhood friends who's kind of reflecting on what was happening with them, and like the perspective and just the look on their faces, like it's really valuable, even if it's a, you know, quote unquote the lowest form.
I don't know. I bet I can make a lower form of documentary. That's the challenge. We're gonna figure it out.
2017.
Moving right along. Oh, wait.
Yeah, that's your challenge for 2017.
She was rooting
Mud.
For
Oh yeah. Yeah. Shitty type of documentary. Like everything's in a flip book. For number three, we got on the top. We're in the top threes. We're rounding the corner of 2016. Everything's basically gold from here on out. Katie, kick us off with something I gave Patches shit for putting on his list much higher than I thought. It's your number three.
It's Sing Street.
Hey.
I love Sing Street. And as I was putting together my top 10, I kind of kept looking at it and thinking, like, maybe it should be lower. It's this little movie. It's about kids. It's cute. But I think it's as ambitious as anything else on this list. It's got these fantastic original songs. It's about ambition. It's about these kids who are kind of trying to get beyond their station and kind of, you know, both rooting for them and I think appropriately skeptical about what happens when you kind of dream of escaping to the big city and becoming a rock star. And then it recreates this. I mean, it creates several like really fantastic music videos, including a Back to the Future inspired 50s prom scene that is just kind of like pure cinematic, like, joy shot into your veins. And yeah, I think that I've liked every movie John Carney has made, including Begin Again, which nobody else liked. I don't totally understand why. I know. I even liked Adam Levine in it. I don't know what to tell you. But Sing Street, I think, I mean, David, you were talking about the movie that people who didn't get to see would like the most, being a bigger splash, and I think that also applies to Sing Street. It is available on iTunes. It is so outrageously charming. And really deserves your attention.
But without taking anything away from that, because I agree with everything you just said, to be perfectly honest, I want to make that clear. Why would you see Sing Street when you could just go see La La Land? I mean, come on.
Oh, my God.
Sing Street is better than La La Land. That's
I will fight you in the streets over this.
That is crazy talk. Sing Street is delightful, but...
Sing Street is the extension of something that feels absolutely true, and La La Land, for me, feels like the extension of something someone thinks... should be true, or someone who lives in
I'm going to have a conniption. I will say that.
And the songs are better in Sing Street.
Yes.
Oh, Jesus Christ. I think that Katie would probably agree with this, though, that as much as she loves all of John Carney's movies, would you agree that he's sort of hit the end of the road with this type of story?
I don't know. I mean, I see what you mean about, you know, like Starry Eyed Dreamers who use music to succeed somehow.
Like, it's a trilogy. He's done it now. Like,
maybe there's a biopic that he can make. Like, so there's someone whose story is appropriate enough to this that he should make that film. I don't know. What he's selling, I'm buying in all of his movies so far. So I don't want to cut him off just yet.
Maybe Ty Sheridan discovers that his old friend Mud was hiding some gold somewhere.
Why?
And I just feel like maybe that could be a
movie.
And
then he starts singing about it.
And yeah, why not? A musical, man, a musical and a horrible documentary. It's a lot of things get piled up on Mud 2 here. Sing Street, man, I guess I'm going to have to see it. I'm going to go to the iTunes, going to make it happen.
Cute
you guys
kids.
Talk to me
cute
about it.
Cute kids singing.
I guess I'm okay with cute kids. Patches, your number 3 was from far enough back in this year. We actually have a review episode for it with Joanna Robinson sitting in for David. So tell us about why Everybody Wants Some has been persistent in your life.
Oh yeah, I think Joanna came on because she was not too fond of the like male relationship broiness of this movie. I don't want to speak for her. Go listen to that review. She might love it. I can't not remember, but I know that people.
No,
were kind
you're hitting on that's somewhat accurate as far as
I
remember.
Yeah, I mean a lot of people had problems with Richard Linklater's spiritual sequel to Dazed and Confused. Everybody Wants Some. I fell hard for this movie. And I was totally not expecting it because the trailers paid, I don't know, something nostalgic and goofy and lightweight. And I think it's much, much more than that. Dave, on the last episode, I think we were talking about ensemble, just like losing your mind over a great cast ensemble. And this is that movie for me, where every person belongs there. Every person has an identity. This is a movie that takes place in Texas, 1980. It's a group of college baseball players. It's following a freshman played by Blake Jenner, who I had never really seen in a movie, who was also in Edge of 17, a very good movie that someone should have put on their list, probably. But,
yeah, someone really should have put on their list. Failed. My bad.
But so he's navigating this new world, unleashed, you know, hormones unleashed, behavior unleashed, cultural understanding unleashed. Everything that could possibly happen in college happens in his first week there. And I think that's really true. I think that's pretty accurate. You know, I am not a devotee of Dazed and Confused. It does not nail something about the high school experience necessarily for me or understand a particular era. That's not me. But this movie got college. And like no other movie I'd ever seen before, and about relationships, the first people you meet and the first adventures you go on and how hilarious they can be and how sad they can be and how pathetic you are when you're a college freshman, I don't know, trying to get a girl or trying to make your way in this new world and put a stamp on it and be somebody. Everybody wants some, but what is some? And it's about figuring that out. And
David's restraining himself for your pull quote.
What is some? Everyone wants some? What's some?
What is it?
It's a great line. No. And of course, the scene where they all sing Rapper's Delight is legendary. I have to shout that out. But I don't know how to contend with the it's too bro-y for its own good or that it needs more female character or something. I think that would kind of slight what it's doing. It would divert its attention and weaken the already sprawling cast. I think the female character that it does have is vivid, and she has a life of her own, and she doesn't put up with anyone's bullshit, and she is not an intruder in this movie at all. And they encounter lots of women over the course of it, but I think it's well.
I mean,
the dynamic is well constructed.
I wish it were. I don't know, Katie saying these words because it'd be a lot easier to swallow, but this is a movie about bros. What do you mean? Like, it's crazy to me that people are like, you know, they needed a stronger female presence. This is the fallacy of representation, is that the fact that we desperately need more movies about women and people of color and by women and people of color does not mean that every movie that happens to be about white dudes is somehow lacking.
Right.
Because this is a movie about white dudes.
Yeah.
It's about the vibe that it can really only
well,
exist.
It's not,
not exclusively white dudes.
White
I mean, there are people of color in this movie, but it's about dudes. It's about college bro-y dudes. And it's about the sort of community that exists between them. The role that women play in that community is very much one of outsiders. They are sort of, they're not seen in the same way their presence would disrupt a lot of the vibe between these guys. you know, you don't want to say that every movie needs to be this way and there's a danger of getting there, but this story does not exist in any other form. I mean, like, this is how it's told.
I think I walked out of Everybody Wants Some and I tweeted something. I mean, I was losing my mind over it, but then my follow-up was really, I want to see every director's Everybody Wants Some. I want everyone to get a chance to tell their Everybody Wants Some, because, as you said, there are lots of different people out there with different perspectives, and I want this movie 100 more times from a really personal place from a diverse amount of directors.
I want the Everybody Wants Some about those drama kids who they hang out with it toward the end of the movie.
Isn't that like Pitch Perfect?
No, it needs to be like weirder and kind of funky.
Your college experience, basically.
I wasn't enough of a drama kid. So there's something in there. But David, I agree with you that this movie's about bros, and representation was not, I mean, not a problem that I had with it. Not that I speak for everybody or anything like that.
There you go.
My main takeaway is that Glenn Powell, who is one of the bros,
movie star,
Everybody Wants Some, goes on to play John Glenn in Hidden Figures. So that was a fun surprise.
I love that guy. Real movie star. This whole cast is going to be super famous people one day. They'll be plucked from this movie and put in movies that people actually see. Hopefully.
They'll all be the McConaughey's from Everybody Wants Some. Moving right along, David, you have picked Jackie as your number three.
Yeah, I mean, I'll just second a lot of what Pat just had to say about it, that, you know, it's, and biopics are so bad by and large these days that it's really easy just to celebrate this one for being different. I think it's a little bit reductive to even think of this as a biopic, although that's become sort of a catch-all for any movie about a historical figure. But I do think that what makes Jackie so effective is that it is about mediating between it's very explicitly about mediating between history and humanity, about, like, you know, in the same way that something like Marie Antoinette was about sort of finding the real person underneath the veneer of history and the celebrity of her day. And I think that, you know, navigating between who this person was, who Jackie Kennedy was, and who the world saw her to be, what her responsibilities were versus what her responsibilities were to herself, how all of this craziness sort of complicated the most traumatic incident of her life. I mean, I think it's was a brilliant idea just to focus this whole story into the days immediately following the assassination, and then, I guess, you know, with occasional visits in its non-chronological approach to some of the events that defined her time in the White House before then. But I thought this movie was not only so smart about grief and about how it's handled and what it can bring out of you, but just, I think, as on the nose as it can be, the ways in which it used grief as a lens to look at celebrity and history and how our understanding, and even less so about Jackie Kennedy, but really as us as the lens, understanding how we see these things, and how all of our ideas of who celebrities were is so obscured by things that were not true, that sort of built around them, and how we talk about the past and the people who defined it with such unearned certainty and with the arrogance of time. And I am not a historian. I'm sure there are historians out there who can talk about any number of subjects with an earned degree of confidence, but I do think that we constantly rewrite who these people are. We tell their stories, to quote Hamilton, but we often get the details wrong, and this movie is not a stickler for what really happened, what the details were or were not. It goes along with sort of the public narrative, but it respects the unknowability of a human private moment and the insufficiency of standing here and just judging it.
Well, to quote Matt Patches, everybody wants some. What's Jackie's some? Maybe we'll discuss that later in the episode.
Mud 2.
When somebody has some answers. All right. Coming up on the big ones, number two, Katie, you have a pick that nobody else has on their list at all.
Well,
Yeah, it's what Jeff Nichols made instead of Mud 2. He made Loving. I caught Loving a couple weeks ago. I was really fascinating to fall so hard for it because Midnight Special was kind of one of my big disappointments of the year. I thought that movie had a lot of good atmosphere to it and then really fell apart on a story level. But Loving is much more the kind of movie that Jeff Nichols has excelled at making thus far in his career. And I think it's less dramatic in a way than Take Shelter or Mud. But it's about this, you know, very important true historical moment of this couple who brought their case to the Supreme Court when they were told by the state of Virginia they couldn't be married because she was black or several races. I think she was black and Cherokee and he was white. So it's about this like huge moment in history. And I think like Jackie takes the weight of history and really makes it intimate and spins it around and makes it about these two people who were living in rural Virginia. They, you know, to varying degrees didn't really want any of this public spotlight, but that's the way the movie presents it. Mildred Loving was kind of the engine that drove them to plead their case because after they were married, they were kind of run out of the county where they'd both grown up and forced to live in D.C. where it was legal for them to live together. Basically, the implication being that in Virginia, they would either continue to be arrested or worse. You know, it doesn't need to show you historical footage of lynchings for you to know that that's there. And just the modesty of this movie and then the way that it burrows down into these two people. I think Joel Edgerton and Ruth Negga are both incredible as Richard and Mildred Loving. You've got this really great brief Michael Shannon appearance. He's been in every Jeff Nichols movie and has been in like 8 movies this year. And he's pretty much just in one scene as a life photographer, but he's terrific. And I think really speaks to how much this movie feels like top to bottom. Really thought out, really affectionate toward all of its characters. And, you know, just like this little piece of history that I think when it premiered at Cannes probably felt really nice. Like, oh, here's, you know, the way that history marches forward. And we, you know, took care of making sure that interracial marriage was possible in the 60s. And now here we are about to elect a first woman president. And seeing it post-election felt really different. And I think the movie is almost more important now to kind of watch at how not that long ago very overt legal racism was part of everyday lives and how that hasn't gone away in a lot of ways and may only get worse. So,
hey, Katie,
yeah.
You can tell the judge I love my wife.
I'm afraid I'm never going to be a Joel Edgerton fan. I can't get into him in any movie. I don't know why.
I have to do that again. That was subpar. Hold on. Tell the judge I love my wife.
Yeah, there's a little more swagger in there than I think he has in the movie. I thought Joel Edgerton was also great in Midnight Special, even though the movie wasn't great. I think I like him in everything. So, Patches, you can go to hell.
Yeah, wow. That first thing performance, that really blows your socks off.
Oh, yeah. I forgot about that.
Joel Edgerton. That was the only time I got to talk to him in person was for The Thing. And that every time I'm like, why did I just pick the shittiest movie to interview you for? But Jeff Nichols Loving... Ruth Negga forever.
Oh, she's so good.
She is incredible.
Although my favorite performance from her is on New York Times Modern Love podcast, reading a story about a woman who falls in love with her turtle, in which she speaks in her natural voice, and I like it's a crime to ever ask her to speak with any other accent because the world needs that. But I was really underwhelmed by this movie.
I think that was why I wasn't expecting as much out of it, because I'd heard mostly that it was just kind of blah.
I really love, I live for understated dramas about repressed love. I mean, come on. and I'm someone, we tend to pass a lot more, so I always feel like I'm reaching by suggesting this, but like I'm someone who's getting prepared to marry someone and be in an interracial relationship, or marriage. I guess I'm already in an interracial relationship. And so I was really primed to be hit by this, in a way. And while I think that it is beautifully rendered, and sensitive and definitely along the lines of how a story like this ought to be told, it just becomes so slack to me. I mean, I don't think that Jeff Nichols is really good at mining understated drama for the pathos and the richness that makes those movies feel so full to me a lot of the time. And by the time they move to DC, I just feel like the movie just dies.
Damn.
Yeah. And also, when I saw it in like October and I was like, wow, this is powerful stuff. And then I think thinking about it after November 8th, I'm like, what a quaint, nostalgic film.
I know.
Man, it's like watching Parks and Recreation.
Oh, God. Yeah.
Okay, nobody was ready for that emotional reality. I will just keep moving on. Number two, Patches. We're coming back to what is probably the only film that all four of us would have shared on a list if I made a top 10 list. It's Moonlight.
Totally. And, I was struggling where to put it. It was teetering on the number one spot for me. But absolutely adore Barry Jenkins' film. We've discussed it many times on this two-parter in the past. But a few bullet points here. One, the Marshala Ali scene. Spoilers for this film, I suppose. if you could call it that. He's getting talked up for the supporting actor Oscar, and he's the favorite, and I feel like that can kind of dampen what an actor gives to a performance and why it's so good. We're not just all rallying behind something because it's good on paper. My God, his scene with the kid, Chiron, at the kitchen table, talking about, am I a faggot? Like, that is the most powerful acting I've seen in years. I really think that
yes.
His explanation, his sensitivity, his looks at Little when he's talking, I just thought that was so profound. And all the stuff when they're kind of chilling in the beginning of the movie, taking him to the beach, that stuff really knocked me out and started this movie on a high point. I really like the other two sections too. I think Andre Holland, a lot of people have been praising Trevante Rhodes, who plays the older Chiron. But I think that stuff is really Andre Holland to dominate. And
so he,
Andre
good.
Holland gets Andre
so
Holland is not... Good. I feel like this movie should have two Oscar frontrunners, and they should be
Andre
Holland.
Andre Holland gives so much for Trevante Rhodes to like play off of. Without what's being delivered and expelled in those scenes, I don't think what Trevante Rhodes observes could seem so profound.
This is the reason why I was in a very long meeting at the Gotham Awards about... trying to single out one of these actors to give ours a breakthrough performance award to. And I really made the case that we should do a award for the entire cast, because I thought that unlike in a way unique to films, at least this year, each of these performances can't exist in a vacuum, even though the actors may not have watched footage or met of the people who play their younger selves or have met those actors. Our attachment to these characters is absolutely dependent upon following this trajectory between one and the other, and even more so than you typically get in a movie where, like Julieta, where, maybe similar to Julieta in that way, where you have, one character played by two different actors, and you just have that, you have both of their parts played out in full. I don't know, I think that, everything that we feel Andre Holland's performance, for example, depends on how we felt about the previous incarnation of Kevin's performance, yeah. And so on. And so it's really difficult for me to single them all out, and it does make me feel like all of the Mahershala Ali Oscar buzz is a bit of a token to represent the entire cast of Moonlight. And I guess it's understandable, because otherwise they would just dominate every category. You could have five supporting actor nominations.
I will say
this alone.
My last 2 points here are, one, I feel like Moonlight kind of works despite Naomi Harris, and I've been joking.
Wow,
this is reductive, 100% reductive, and borderline mean. But at times I feel like Naomi Harris is in Lee Daniels Moonlight, and doing kind of over the top, exaggerated, to be controlled by Jenkins using editing, and I don't know. It seems a little reckless, or off. Out of the lane, if you will, from some of the other movies. But
I'm not crazy about her either.
Yeah, but the movie, obviously, it's number two on my list, so I still love this movie despite that. And the one last point I want to make is that Barry Jenkins, the direction in this movie, it's just all the right angles. You know, when you're making a movie in a real place, and my guess is, I don't know, that, that you kind of go around town and you find your locations. The location scout should win an Oscar in this movie, or the locations manager. Because I think they built sets, right? Or did they?
Well, a lot of it was pulled from the actual places that were pertinent to Barry Jenkins' own childhood.
Right, so
even
he
though
found
this story
places,
did not necessarily originate with
him. He knew these places, and I just feel like he captures them. The camera's always in the right place to feel that location, and on a symbolic level, on a visceral level. I just love the way that he shoots this movie. So that's Moonlight. We talked about it a lot.
Oh, and we might not be done with it, not to spoil too much. But first, number two, David, you picked a period piece that is about a Scottish farm girl?
Yeah, I thought we all would, no? Yeah, Sunset Song. What a movie. Terrence Davies. If you're not on the Terrence Davies bandwagon, I don't know what you're doing with yourself. He's only got so many films left, and it's got to be in the 70s now. But yeah, this is an extraordinarily beautiful movie. It stars Agnes Dean, a model, supermodel, I don't know, who gives what to my mind is the best, I was going to say female, but I think probably just the best performance of the year, as a girl who is growing up in rural Scotland in the years before World War I. And it's just sort of about her her life on the farm there and finding her place in this community and eventually getting married to a guy who, and she has a brutish father who's played by Peter Mullen, the great Peter Mullen. And she eventually marries a guy who she meets in a scene that actually reminded me of the furthest thing from a Terrence Davies movie, which is the fish tank scene from Romeo and Juliet, Baz Luhrmann's Romeo ampersand Juliet, where they see each other.
How dare you? It's a plus sign.
It is a plus sign.
That's right. Sorry. Of course. They see each other across a road that is crowded with passing sheep. And, it's a great scene, and it cuts to them on the train. I mean, they've met before, but it cuts them on the train and they hold hands. It's so good. But then he goes off to war and he comes back a very different man, and she has to grapple with that. And a lot of it is sort of about her relationship and her people's relationship to this land and what it is that defines who we are, the roots that we put down, the passage of time, our sort of relationship in just the eons of in the overall chronology of this world and the place, the small corner of it that we tend to inhabit in our lives. It's such an immensely moving movie, especially on repeat viewings where the nuances of it can really be picked up, because Terrence Davies leaves nothing escapes his eye. And wow, is this beautifully shot. I mean, if it were more widely seen, I think it would very much be in the conversation regarding the year's best cinematography. But the shots of Agnes Dean's character and the other people in her village in the wheat fields and the bright blue skies, the yellow wheat fields. I mean, it's just so, so beautiful. And feels so true to that period of time, as I would know, because I spent a lot of time in 1918, Scotland. it's a really, really phenomenal movie that I think stands up there with just about anything Terrence Davies has made, as difficult as it might be to compete with something like The Long Day Closes. And he's got a new movie coming out early next year, which I've missed several opportunities to see and can't wait and hear very, very wildly, excitingly divergent things about, starring Cynthia Nixon, about Emily Dickinson, called The Quiet Passion. So, called Divergent. So Sunset Song is on Netflix. Yeah. Watching Sunset Song on your computer is like a hate crime, but I understand at this point it's about the best you can do.
Hey, Netflix goes everywhere. If there's a screen, they could probably play like your baseball town Jumbotron. Netflix streams.
Where was that to be seen?
Netflix scales. Yeah. Everybody knows.
Yeah, you owe it to yourself to watch this movie.
We should start screening more 4:3 Jumbotron movies, don't you guys think?
Yeah.
All right, here we go. It's the big conclusion. The maybe best movies of 2016. Katie, I'm going to let you do the big reveal here.
Mine's Jackie. We've talked about it a good deal. I don't want to, and I agree with basically everything you guys have said, and I don't want to make everything about the election in these last couple entries, which it seems like it's been, but I watched this some point after the election, and I just couldn't help thinking about this notion of a woman in the White House and the way that a lot of this movie is kind of men standing around being like, well, what does she want to do? I mean, we have to wait for her call. And it's Jackie Kennedy kind of demanding that she make her husband's funeral what she wants it to be and asserting this power to a bunch of men who aren't really used to having a woman tell them what to do and certainly never expected this woman to tell them what to do. And I thought the way it handles that and the way it looks at Jackie Kennedy, not as especially ambitious, she didn't want to be in political office, but she was just put into this position and did find a power and did really assert herself, totally fascinated me in the wake of finding out we wouldn't have a female president. And Natalie Portman's great in this. I don't know if we talked enough about her. She's got this great restraint and kind of meanness in Jackie Kennedy. The way that it cuts between her in the White House and then about a week later doing an interview with a reporter played by Billy Crudup, and how she'll say something and then he'll say, can I quote you on the record? And she'll say, no, I never said that. And just cuts him to the bone. It's this great, like, waspy viciousness. Yeah, I love Jackie. Yeah. I can't wait to watch it again.
The lack of credit that Natalie Portman has got for this has been, I mean, I understand that in one sense she's gotten plenty. She'll be in the awards conversation and so on. But there have been a lot of people who have said that her performance is like a cartoon.
They don't like her voice.
Others that have said that it's mimicry. And it's like, one, I am always saying that fidelity to real life is not a helpful metric in measuring the quality of a film. However, it is unassailably true that if you listen to the tapes of Jackie Kennedy speaking, Natalie Portman nailed it. But I think what Katie said about finding that meanness, finding the dimension to it, is absolutely key in that she wasn't just doing an act of mimicry here. She really was developing a character that sort of leveraged real life to go somewhere a lot deeper artistically. I think it's a brilliant performance.
Well, I'm interested in seeing it because wouldn't Natalie Portman performance with the weird accent is just the Phantom Menace to me. So let's see if there's something different about it.
I can't imagine how there's anything different between the two.
All right, Patches, you have an interesting surprise pick that when you emailed me, I'm like, huh, I knew he liked this movie, but I didn't know he liked this movie so much.
I really, really do. And a lot of people do not. Like, Wiener Dog by Todd Solondz.
Wow.
Going for it.
I saw that. So that was on someone's worst of the year list. I don't remember where I saw it.
Totally,
but
I believe it. You know, a few years ago, The Comedy was my number one, and I think that made a few worst lists too. So I have a tendency to go this direction, but that's fine.
Going rogue. Rogue One.
I was shocked by, you know, I'm not necessarily the biggest Todd Solondz fan. I am in awe of his personality and his ability to make the films that he wants. I do think he's a mad genius, and they don't all work for me, but I'm always interested in what he does because of his dark humor and his observations on the kind of mundanity of life and people, you know, outside the bubble, whatever that means to you or to him. I think it's clear what it means to him. But so Wiener Dog is this broken up into four pieces, and they're all stories about people living with their pets, and in this case, a wiener dog. And all of the observations here are all about life and death, and how we're dealing with the hurdles that we encounter in life, and what pets mean to us, and how we use them, and how we attach ourselves to them, and what they can do and complicate our lives, how we learn about life and death through the dogs, or the cats, or whatever kind of pet you have, in this case, the Wiener Dog. And I really found the dark humor, again, like the first story is Julie Delpy just snapping at her son about this dog that he's obsessed, this little boy is obsessed with this dog, and it has this just, the humor is so cruel, it's so hilarious. And it could, that kind of streak continues as it twists and turns. They're not interlocking stories, so Greta Gerwig shows up. That this movie got a lot of buzz out of Sundance because he revived Don Wiener from Welcome to the Dollhouse for this movie. It really has no connection to that. I did not go in. I still haven't rewatched Welcome to the Dollhouse. Does anyone know? David, you saw this movie. Do you feel like it has an attachment to Welcome to the Dollhouse, or it's just a weird, like, world building?
Not in a meaningful way.
Greta Gerwig is great. She's having an amazing year. I probably should have put 20th Century Woman on my top 10. She's in Jackie. I think she's an amazing actress who I've really come to love. And here she is more of an observer. She's taking a back seat as other people are dealing with problems. And I mean, she runs away from her job with a wiener dog and goes on the road with Kieran Culkin. I mean, I could go and summarize all these bits, but I think the key here is Todd Solondz's observations on everything. This movie is all encompassing and hilarious and tragic. And doesn't totally work. I mean, there's a third story with Danny DeVito as a screenwriter, clearly a little autobiographical on Solondz's part, and it's a really weird diversion from the rest of the movie, but I still dug it. I mean, it's just such a personal vehicle for him, and number one.
Possibly the only movie ever made where the intermission is the best part.
That's true. That's a Wiener Dog theme song.
I mean, also, have you guys revisited, what is it, the fucking Scarlett O'Hara one? That had a pretty badass intermission.
Gone with the Wind. Lawrence of Arabia's
Gone with the Wind
one too.
Well, but Lawrence of Arabia is good. Gone with the Wind's just long and technicolor and glossing over racism all the time.
Oh, I see. So anyway, the intermission is the best part because you get a break.
Yeah, for sure. You get a break, and it's a good intermission. They got that big painting. They got the score. I'm down for it. Anyway, I don't want to over-talk Wiener Dog, which, Patches, you sent me your list that began with Patterson and ended with Wiener Dog. I was like, here we go with Matt Patches.
And then he put Sing Street on there.
So, yeah, full of surprises. David, your number one pick, I think, might be our group number one pick for things that were, like, rated highest. As I said before, hit it up.
Yeah, I think probably the world's number one pick for this year. It's hardly, unlike Patch's pick, could not be less of a surprise, is Moonlight.
Hey!
For the second consecutive year, I'm going with a small film that revolves around two queer characters who are struggling with their feelings for one another in a time and place that isn't especially friendly to them.
Mm-hmm. What's the other one, in case people have forgotten?
Carol.
What you picked last year. There we go.
I've learned between Carol and Moonlight the last year and then this year, and then thinking back to, like, Before Midnight and Lost in Translation and some of the other films that would have been on my number one spot if we were doing podcasts back then, I think that I, not to take anything away from Moonlight, which is connected with so many different people from so many different backgrounds and so many different interests, but that I may be especially susceptible to movies about two people trying to, you know, kindle or struggle or, you know, negotiate an impossible love. I mean, I don't know what more is left to be said about this movie. I have hardly contributed the greatest amount of insight to it compared to anybody out there. I don't even think I've really written about it at any length, but there's a ton of great writing out there by all types of people. I think it's an extraordinarily beautiful movie. The middle works for me just as well as anything else, even if the last third is especially strong and really takes the wind out of you when this movie ends. It ends kind of abruptly once it's said everything that it needs to say, and the more I mull it over, the more I think that was the perfect way to do that. Every tactical part of this movie is just works into one beautifully cohesive whole, from Nicholas Britell's music to the music diegetically Barry Jenkins brings into the film, the cinematography from the guy who shot he shot like some Adam Sandler movie last or something. I can't remember. It's one of those wild jumps. But it's a beautiful film. The performances across the board are great. The writing is just, I mean, in a way that is, I, again, not to be reductive about it, is very similar to the flow of Carol, the rhythm of Carol, the weight that silences, looks, gestures are given over words necessarily, and therefore how much more of a weight each word carries with it, particularly pronounced in that final beautiful sequence. This movie knocked me sideways, and I am just so glad that the rest of the world has been just as vocal about championing it. It's that rare, beautiful film that that I think, you know, it's the empathy that it could. I don't know. I wish that more people.
You're saying see it. See it.
But it's, the problem is that, like, you know, it's making good money for a movie of its size. It's going to get outsized attention when award season really picks up the pace. But it does feel like it's all within our bubble, that people who are predisposed to rolling with a story like this are fawning over it, which is great. But it does feel like the people whom this could actually do some sort of, you know, human social good in changing them from the roots on up, are avoiding
more
it,
like, likely to watch Netflix's Luke Cage and think they did a good job.
Yeah,
I'm gonna show it to my family over Christmas, and we'll see how it goes.
It's not, I also don't want to say, like, you know, pat ourselves on the back for watching this movie about Black people who are given a story that is seldom told in that community, but I do think, on just the most basic level, it's hard to deny that this could be an eye-opening experience for people who have been exposed only to media that limits that representations to a dangerous degree.
All right, guys. That was 2016, and I kind of feel bad that nobody brought up Swiss Army Man, but whatever, I just said the words.
So good.
Yeah, no, I like dead Daniel Radcliffe, and you know me, I usually pick a number one movie that's about the plight of a lonely white guy, so I apologize that once again this year that would have been true.
Well, I chose Manchester by the Sea, so...
Yeah. Swiss Army Man will only find its audience in time. I think people are really going to catch up with that movie.
Yeah, and I still like the soundtrack, a whole bunch of good things. Guys, it was a big year for us personally. A lot of shit went down, and that was some good top 10 podcasting. How about we... let Patches get to Rod Patches' party, which he's listening to this episode after it's already happened. So
Rod Patches didn't
was late.
Invite us also, which I'm a little offended by.
Next year.
I mean, we'll get there. We'll get to the Patches farm. So until then, where can people find more of your work? Maybe from this year, maybe in the upcoming year. Let's link out to the internet, beginning with Miss Katie Rich.
I'm at vanityfair.com, where you won't find as much writing as you used to, but I'm still there. I'm talking on the Little Gold Men podcast there a lot, where we'll also have a top 10 episode in the coming, well, actually, as you hear this, it's already been out, so go listen to that. And, you know, I'll still be there in the new year. And I'm on Twitter at Katie Rich, KateyRich, where I've really enjoyed people talking about finally seeing Hunt for the Wilder People and Sing Street. So I accept those as my personal brand. Keep it coming. Oh, and we're also all on Twitter. And we're all on Twitter at FITWR. Please talk to us about our top 10s. Whatever else, I'm sure we'll all still be looking at Twitter even over the holidays.
Oh, for sure. All the time. Movies, all the time. Fighting in the War Room. Matt Patches, where can people find more of your work on the internet?
Yeah, I'm senior entertainment editor at Thrillist.com. I'm on Twitter at Mr. Patches. And actually, my best movies list is going to be 50 deep soon. I've been keeping it and organizing it throughout the entire year. So if you want to read all the movies that I've enjoyed, you can go search for best movies of 2016 Thrillist or something and find it.
Yeah, I was really grateful for that project when I was on maternity leave and trying to figure out what I really needed to hit. It was a
heard that from
curated
people.
List. So I hope you do that again next year.
I will. And we have a website, fightinginthewarroom.com, where we'll put up the episodes. You can listen to them, share them, or you can leave comments of your own. Fightinginthewarroom.com.
Yep, I'm going to fix that up. Oh, well, I'm passing to you, David. Let me pass to you.
I'm waiting.
Okay, here we go. The person that you've been waiting to hear from this whole time, David Ehrlich, telling you where you could find more of his work online. Here we go.
Dis. the person you would wish would speak less at every opportunity, I'm sure. I'm David Ehrlich. You can find me on Twitter, riling shit up about La La Land, apparently. David Ehrlich, and you can also find me at IndieWire, where I'm the senior film critic, and have written about a lot, but not all of these movies. You can watch a video of my top 25 favorite movies of the year. The link is in my pinned tweet, so easy enough to find. You can find all of us together talking about movies in 2017, and also on Facebook.
I'm Dave Gonzalez, but my first name, DA7E. I've been confusing Mud with the 2013 David Gordon Green movie Joe, which also had Ty Sheridan hanging out with an old guy he learned things from. But until Joe 2, Legends of Joe's Cold, actually comes out, you can find more of me on Geek.com and Thrillist.com, and the rest of our podcast at FightingInTheWarRoom.com. Search for the hashtag Top10s. You will get all the ones we have done. And go see some good movies. You've got vacation. You're on it right now. Till next time, talk to you guys later.